Thank you for joining us again for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a weekly call-in show geared towards the hobby side of all things television. Brought to you by Satellite Guys Radio. Now here are your hosts.
Good evening, Satellite Nation.
Hello, I'm Michael, K4EST.
And I'm Brian Gohl, a.k.a. Titanium, and that was my tribute to the memory of the great Robin Williams, who passed this last week. Well, Michael, okay, what do we have on top this week?
This week on Satellite Nation, we have a special guest. We got to sit down and interview the other evening. Syed Karim, he's the founder and CEO of OuterNet.
You know, and last night we had a great sit down with him, and we learned a lot about the OuterNet service, you know, the technology, and really how we as a satellite nation can get involved with this project.
Yeah, and I learned a lot myself too, and I'm really, really interested in this because I've got some of the equipment already that we need to make it work. And so next couple of days, I want to try to set something up and see if I can start decoding some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I kind of came into it just off of some of the conversations on Satellite Guys, and I was just really kind of blown away by some of the stuff he was presenting to us. And, you know, I really started realizing that us as Satellite Guys and Satellite Nation really can get involved with this, and there's a lot of things that we can do to even get involved with the technology, and it isn't just about the data. We can really have fun with this.
Oh, yeah. That's the fun part about it. I love it. It's just being able to set, you know, hook everything up and, you know, you'll see, you know, he talks about other ways of doing it, maybe even going through an Android app. He said you might be able to set it up, and if you get some kind of dongle hookup, you know, so it really, really.
Don't spoil everything for us tonight there. Well, hey, I want to put a big thank you out to Satellite Nation for your suggestions for the Tech Corner segment, and this is featured in the second half of the show tonight. We're going to open up the telephone lines at about 40 minutes after the hour, and we're going to discuss connecting C-band and Ku-band motorized dish to your satellite system.
Yeah, so you want to jot down the number if you want to call in and have a question for us later. That number will be 1-877-SAT-GUYS or 877-728-4897.
Now, if you miss an episode of Satellite Nation, each the link on Satellite Guys Radio Forum, and that's found at www.satelliteguys.us. Now, if you're not already a member of Satellite Guys, we invite you to stop by and check out the many forums for, they include like Satellite for Dish Network, DirecTV, Free to Air. There's some IPTV, Over the Air TV, telephones. What's some of your favorites?
I guess you threw that back to me. You still sound a little bassy to me. So there's all sorts of, the Satellite Guys just everything. It's kind of like Satellite Nation. We don't just talk about satellites, anything technology related.
You know, I'm just really impressed every time I kind of look around the site. You know, I kind of look at one forum or another, but, you know, there's quite a bit out there, discussion on television programming. So, you know, we invite you, if you're not already a Satellite Guy, stop by www.satelliteguys.us, and I think you'll find a great home base or at least a great place to visit.
I agree. It's definitely a good place to go, and it's a good homey place. It's not one of those ones that you just don't want to go to and whatever. But we really make you feel at home when you come over Satellite Guys. Anyway, Brian, you want to have you got that queued up over there? And we'll let everybody listen to this interview.
Joining Michael and I this evening is Syed Karim, founder and CEO of OuterNet. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
We're doing great. Thank you for joining us this evening. Could you briefly describe what is OuterNet?
So OuterNet is a broadcast data service that is universally accessible on KU band.
Now, in a connected world like we live in now, what is the purpose? What is the need for OuterNet?
Oh, okay. So, yes, I do believe that we live in a hyper-connected world, and I am, of the privileged fraction of humanity that gets to live in that. But when it comes down to it, there's probably only about a third of us that get to say that. And so, naturally, that leaves two-thirds who really have no idea of the type of information and the breadth of knowledge that we all have access to and that take for granted. And so the reason why this is important is because this allows us to offer a significant amount of information to those who would not otherwise have it.
Now, who developed the OuterNet idea?
It's a problem that I've been thinking about for probably on the order of about 6 years. I had originally went to graduate school at the University of Illinois, thinking that I wanted to pursue, it ended up being that I realized I was not an academic, but my area of interest was the econometrics of information, and essentially how information access impacts the quality of life and the economic output of a society. So that's an area that stuck with me for many years, and as I went off into consulting, as I went off into working in media, and then also in working in private equity or investments, it's really just a matter of a problem set that I've always been aware of. And when I finally, and in about the last year or so, realized that it was time for me to start something of my own, and when it's a matter of starting something, it's also a matter of identifying a problem. Always with me. I've lived in several different countries, and lived over the over the U.S. as well. And so this is something that to me just felt that offering a universal information service, regardless of infrastructure or income, was a problem that was interesting to me, and that was also was an opportunity. I think it's a huge business opportunity, and so that's how it originated.
So you're saying about 6 years ago, so around 2008 is when you started developing the idea?
So I wouldn't necessarily say that I was developing the idea. What I had identified was the problem and how to define it. I don't think I actually came to an idea on what the best way to solve it was for another 5 or 6 years. It was about, let's say this is 2014, September. I would say about 16, 17 months ago is when I start thinking, I know how to solve this problem. I know what's realistic. I know what things cost. I know what technology looks like. I know what research is. I know what development is. I know what risk is. And that's really what it came about. So I would say, on the order of about a year and a half ago was when much of this, came together.
Okay, so that's when you said, okay, I'm going to do this.
One-way push of information, of something that someone requests and then you provide it to them. Is that correct?
So there's two parts right there. It is a one-way push. It's a broadcast data service. But even though it's broadcast, the more appropriate term would be an interactive broadcast. And so when you just said that someone requests, when someone makes a request, like for example in on internet services, there's always that. With packets, there's the acknowledgement that the packets have been received at the individual level. And so for OuterNet, that's actually something that doesn't happen. It's a broadcast service. There's no acknowledgement. And so we just push information, we push data. The way that it works, though, is that it's not as if there are some, editors or gatekeepers in London or New York that are saying, hey, the world is going to consume X, Y, or Z content. What we do is we use a different return path for content, for of content or demand of topics or demand of interest. And so we use the crowd internationally to be able to determine what should be pushed out over transponders.
Now, on your site, I see mention of democratically chosen library of content. What does that mean?
So what that means is it kind of goes back to what I just mentioned about, you know, no gatekeepers or editors in chief, or, you know, in the Middle East, Southern Africa, whatever. Ultimately, it shouldn't be about individuals that are determining what the topic of conversation is or what people want to consume. It should be individuals. And so when we talk about a separate return path of information, what I mean by that is that in much of the world, I would say the number right now is about 75% of the world is covered by a GSM network. You know, of course, the U.S. is an anomaly with GSM and, you know, other formats, but mostly GSM. But the thing to keep in mind that doesn't necessarily mean 3G or 4G. You know, oftentimes what 3G GSM still means is just GPRS. However, GPRS actually can do a whole lot, and 75% of humanity can offer some kind of a vote as to what they want, and especially if it doesn't cost them anything, then that's a valuable service for us. And so what that means as far as democratically chosen is different paths to than what is typical when it comes to satellite communications or SATCOM is we allow people to use, let's say, Facebook Zero or SMS, USSD, email, Twitter, whatever it ends up being. Now, those are all things that most of those are saying, oh, okay, well, those are actually Internet services. Well, they're Internet services, but in many places of the world, those are actually free Internet services, and the reason for that is because the telcos realize that it's in their best interest to offer kind of a taste of the Internet so that people buy data services. But for our purposes, they can essentially cast their ballot in terms of what kind of content they want distributed, higher bandwidth content, higher volume content over satellites, and that's exactly the way we operate.
Now, on your website, I see something you refer to it as the information priority list. Now, would that be data that people have basically voted for or put in a request for, and you see that there is an interest in that type of data, and so it moves into that priority list? Or tell us more about that.
So the information priority list is based on demand collected in the field by users or interest, and that's what we use to determine what content should be selected and send out. And it's not just a matter of individual pieces of content. For example, if we see that there is a 20% demand in soccer scores, then it's not as if we just IBC website and just send that. We'll actually take several of them, including the Wikipedia one, so that people have different perspectives on the same topic. So that's what the priority list indicates, really demand. And then ultimately at the demand that actually flows into the archive that's presented and broadcast over satellite.
Yeah, so what is the current technology you're using to distribute the information from OuterNet through the satellites? And I see you're right now using G19 in North America and Hotbird 8 over in Western Europe.
That's correct. So right now, the goal was to be able to be as standards-based as possible, to be hit as many people as there were installed users. And so definitely North America is, it's funny compared to much of the world because of the DBBS standard and also because of the penetration that, you know, DirecTV and dish networks have here. But yes, G19, we're on, I don't remember. And I don't remember the rest, but and Hotbird in Europe and MENA, we go all the way out. Of course, you know, Hotbird has a great, you know, footprint all the way out to Moscow. Even when we move past this our current kind of technical development stage, we'll go past 2 transponders. We'll eventually be on either 7 or 8 to have mostly. I think we'll hit like on the order of about 92% to 94% of humanity. That'll include most likely AsiaSat 5 on their C-band and their various reasons in China, because that actually makes more sense on C-band because they have in many of the apartment buildings C-band dishes on them which pipe in over cable that input and that's been installed user. Well, then in South Asia, I think it's ABS-2 is the most popular. And that's really kind of, you'll see a trend, is it's really just you go wherever the most number of free-to-air channels exist and where people are already pointing. North or Central Asia, Northern Asia, it ends up being Yamal 200 or 300 in the South Pacific or Oceania. It ends up being Aptus 2D, and then a Hispasat 1E in Latin America. And I may be leaving some. I left out Africa. There's actually a toss-up there. I think our best bang for the buck is going to be Intelsat 20, IS-20 in that region. So that after getting all of those, we'll be hitting, you'll be hard-pressed to find a place in the world where we're not covering.
Now, what you're talking about are basically geosynchronous satellites. So with those, user does need to have a dish and receiving software. But it looks like what you're talking about is that you're going to use these downlinks as kind of hubs to feed other distribution methods?
Sure, yeah. So we're leaving the problem set as regard as the last mile. For us, it's not really the last mile. It's almost like the last couple feet. And what I mean by that is that the most prevalent radio RF system that exists right now in the world with 10 billion of these radios is Wi-Fi. And so instead of requiring someone to have a television, and piping the receiver back into some kind of a larger screen, what we realize is that if you look at mobile penetration, if you look at even laptops, that's really where the technology trend and user adoption is. And so what we're saying is, hey, you know what? All of those nowadays, and even for the past 3 or 4 years, it's been standard Wi-Fi. So we're just going to go ahead and create a system that has of Wi-Fi and distribute all that content from a local web server over Wi-Fi.
Okay, so this data is continuously streaming, and I imagine it's then archived locally, and then it's out. So once this data comes down, could you describe the process that someone would access that data?
Sure, not a problem. So we have a very open philosophy when it comes to both hardware and software. We're looking for our entire stack of software to be open source, and definitely when it comes to the hardware, we will eventually be manufacturing some, but by no means do we care if you buy from us or from anyone else, and we'll even identify all the different components that are compatible, and we'll write software for that as well. We think the value really is in having a pervasive in terms of service, rather than going down the path of conventional SATCOM and saying, oh, you have to buy our stuff and we have to have our proprietary hardware and software stack on it. So as far as the path goes is what's really required, of course, you have to have your 60-plus centimeter dish, your LNB, and then it's that's all standard. And then it gets down to what is required to receive OuterNet. We will eventually have an Android app because we've noticed that many of the modern set-top boxes are going towards Android. We've looked at the API, and they've exposed the levers that we need in order to be able to send our MPEG, fully qualified MPEG to transport stream that has that's really leveraging the ancillary data layer and sending it out through Android and using some software to be able to say, here's a stream, now we need to turn that stream into a file. As it works right now is we focused on basically one solution, and the reason we focus on that one is because it's very hacker oriented and open source and maker oriented, and that's using a Raspberry Pi and all the different parts of the Pi that work really well, both operating system and also the 802.11 radios that you can buy for $8 and which turn that Raspberry Pi into a hotspot. So right now you hook into Linux compatible. There's a whole set of them. If you look at linuxtv.org, they go ahead and outline all the USB tuners. We've identified what is most likely probably the least expensive of the bunch. And of course, there are many more that we will be testing future. So we have the drivers and also the software that's freely available to be able to turn that file into a stream. You flash or create a copy of the operating system, whether it's Arch Linux or whether it's Raspbian. What happens there is we make sure we insert the packages that allow it to hotspot and also have our stream to file software. And then at that point, once everything's up and running, which like I mentioned earlier, it's no simple task as of right now, but eventually it will be. But once everything is in place, all the software is in place, then it's just a matter of connecting to the Outernet network. And if you'll see, you'll notice on the website, there's a how-to section, and it has a couple of links back to the GitHub account and where all the I think is most important is look at the video. It's about a minute 30, and it shows the entire system in operation. You know, says, okay, well, here's the dish, LNB, coax coming back onto a Raspberry Pi, and then shows the user connecting to the Outernet network, and then you see the pages and the web server display all the content that is in the folders or the download directory.
Very good. So what we're referencing here for everyone listening is the website for Outernet, and that's www.outernet.is. So it's www.outernet.is. And on that page, you're going to find links to their Twitter, Facebook, Google social accounts. So I visited your site, some very good information on there, very informative, very good job on that. Now, once that data comes down, and it's, I imagine, archived on a then you'll have some sort of a library or indexing system that the local users can access that data that's been filling this hard drive?
That's correct. So naturally, that user experience is really driven by open source software. So yes, there's a UX that we have, but you know, anyone can go ahead and just go to the directory level and see what, do ls and see everything that pops out. But our user experience is something that we call Librarian, and Librarian offers kind of a view of, downloaded, what has been favorited. It gives you a kind of a timestamp of various things, and in the future it'll say, hey, we have a new software update, and you can choose to install it if you want to. And, of course, there will be more features like, for example, tagging, which allows you to say, hey, I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in sports. Go ahead and throw everything else away. Those are the only things I'm interested in, and save those locally. I'm interested in Russian content and Russian content about literature, and those are the only things that get saved locally. Or, of course, like you've mentioned, yes, there is the ability to index all the content locally. That is actually a feature that hasn't been built out just yet. And the major reason for that is that we're trying to focus this on being very limited, as far as hardware goes, limited in terms of specs. And so we want to make sure that we're not taxing the hardware in any way. So it's also it's something that we want to offer that works well before it's offering something that doesn't work at all.
You just answered what I was going to ask you, because if you've got a hard drive that's X amount of gigabytes or whatever, and if it keeps storing this stuff, it's eventually going to have a bunch of stuff maybe you don't want on there. So that's what I was going to ask is, and you answered that with the tagging, and then it what you're saying is it deletes the rest of it off the hard drive that you don't want?
Correct. So actually, when it comes to the tagging feature and you start to what your interests are, those files that aren't in line with that taxonomy, they're not even ever saved. So basically, the local client looks at files and says, oh, okay, well, this isn't about sports, this isn't about weather, throw it away. And that's a way to be able to make the best use out of your limited storage. And storage can be one of two ways. One can be hard drive. Hard drives are pretty cheap with the amount of space that they have available. Or, my has a micro SD and I only have 4 gigs available, and so everything stays over there. So it's really kind of determining or understanding what various use cases are and designing around that. But also, there's a feature set that is actually not released just yet. But one of the feature is at what point in time do I save stuff and just throw it away? So you mark and saying, hey, my archive stuff I keep indefinitely, or my favorite archive stuff, it only stays in there for. And one of the things that you'll notice when you see Librarian is that it has very prominently displayed, saying this is the amount of space that you have left. So you have to determine what you want in it and what you don't want in your library.
Very, very interesting. Now, I do have one question. Is this family safe? What determines what information is getting pushed?
Yeah, no, you. So to answer your question off the bat, One is, yes, it's family safe, but the other side of it, it introduces another not an easy question or even problem, which is, you know, one thing that we don't want to do is act as a censor. We have no desire to do that. As a matter of fact, one of the founding principles of not just, you know, Outernet, but also, I mean, my graduate work was at the University of Illinois, you know, School of Library and Information Sciences. So, and in the U.S., you know, one of the founding principles for that field is that no library should act as a censor. It's a matter of the they want to and don't want to consume at an individual level. And so, you know, family safe, yes, I think that's really fundamentally important. But, you know, once you get past, you know, there's just some things that I think we can all agree that, you know, probably should not be exposed to everyone at large. But once you get past, you know, things of that adult nature, then it goes into the items like, hey, if there is a lot of demand to be for people to be able to explore or understand the topic, I don't. And we have internally discussed it, how to properly determine how to, you know, distribute that information, disseminate it. But in some cases, it's going to be really kind of dicey. And I mean, we're going to actually ask our community to help us to find the answer, because that's the only way.
And I really appreciate your candor with this. You know, right now, it looks like it's quite techy for someone to get into this. You know, Michael and I were talking about this, and, you know, he has a lot of interest in Raspberry, et cetera, and so he has a lot of interest. But, you know, for the average person, right now it does feel, what are you taking to offer a solution for people that maybe aren't attracted to the technology, but they want the information?
If you look at the technology adoption curve for basically anything in the last 30 years, you'll see the forefront is also those who are, like, just knee-deep and want to see the zeros and ones. And that's where we are really right now, kind of immersed. And that's why we really chose the Raspberry Pi community, because they like to tinker with stuff. They like to, and they're perfectly fine with something that doesn't work exactly like the documentation states, right? But
yeah.
we know that that's not where the knee or that inflection point is. And that inflection point is really where you turn something into a solid consumer product, and that's what we're headed towards. For example, I've mentioned before with Android, we can offer like in the Google Play store an application that you can download from to an Android-based set-top box. Now, I know that, let's say, for example, I think a really sharp guy, and I know that he's been involved in the North American free-to-air community. I forget what the name of the company is, but they just recently released a fairly inexpensive Android-based set-top box, and we think we can write some software at the application layer that just allows you to go ahead and download it, and then you're able to download Outernet content, and it works, and it turns everything into a hotspot, and it will work, hopefully, turnkey. So that's really what we need. We need something that's just a matter of, like, your iTunes experience. On the other side of things is being able to repurpose existing stuff in a very consumer-oriented fashion as well, which is, let's say, we want to be able to plug in a inexpensive DVB-S tuner to a router, to your Linksys router, right? Anything that can run something called OpenWRT or Tomato, these are all open source wireless operating systems. Anything that can run those stuff should be able to run our entire stack. And at that point, I mean, you're talking that is acting as a local wireless local area network, $30. It's going to be hard to beat that price point. So, and we think we can do it to a point to where it's like, hey, just download this, flash this, and, you know, 1, 2, 3, you're done. And then, of course, I think the real end goal is saying everyone can play with all this stuff however they want to. We'll give the best instructions that we know how. But ultimately, you know, you really want to go to the store. Some people want to go to the store and pay $50, whether it's online or on Amazon, or if it's whether it's in Nigeria, whether it's in Kenya, or it's in Bangladesh, or in Siberia. You know, there should be a reseller that's been saying, hey, you know what, here's this box just works. You plug it in, and it just goes ahead, listens to the signal, and turns it into a hotspot. That's really where the win is at the ultimate, at the end of the day. And we're a ways away from that. But, I mean, ultimately, like I said, the whole process is very open in nature, and we would love for, you know, the community to help us get there even faster.
So you're eventually going to yourself try to develop something yourself that you can just sell that's just plug and play.
I mean, I know how difficult it is to make hardware. I've worked in product development before, and it is by no means an easy task. And distribution is even harder, especially in many of the markets that we want to be in. So I hesitantly say yes, although I would just really love if there was someone else who was better at this stuff to come over and take over and go ahead and be better at it. So ultimately, what we want to do is provide that information service and focus our efforts there. But we know that we need to seed the market with hardware in order for it first to get there. You know, if DMSI wants to ever push something out, or if Shenzhen builds something that ends up costing $20 and does the exact same thing, hey, then great, please do it. But until that happens, you know, we have to go ahead, step up, and then do it.
Right.
Now, I see your funding is coming from Media Development Investment Fund. What can you tell us about this?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I can actually tell you quite a bit about it. The things I've done before starting Adornet, and I had been the manager of a fund. It was a seed fund for early stage startups at Media Development Investment Fund. And what is not unheard of at various types of investment funds is that, you know, some of the principals will go off and say, hey, it's time for me to do my own thing. And then, you know, there's a good relationship, and they say, okay, well, you know, if it's in line with what we invest in, then I think maybe we should invest. So that's where the existing relationship was. What Media and Development Investment Fund is an impact investment fund. And what they've been doing for almost 20 years is investing in independent media throughout the world, and actually in really difficult markets related to free press and access to information. So they're investing in newspapers in southern Russia and Siberia that aren't owned by oligarchs or aren't owned by you know, the state government. Or the government, and they're also like Macedonia, you know, Zimbabwe, you know, South Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia. You know, basically, want to step up and say, you know, we'll take a chance on journalists, we'll take a chance on media entrepreneurs, and we'll go ahead and take a claim, take something in the ground, and say that we believe in this, and we think there's both a need from a societal aspect and also market opportunity. And so that's what they've been doing, is providing accessible financing for media entrepreneurs for the past 20 years.
Very good. Now, listeners have an opportunity to get involved with your company. So if somebody's listening tonight, they like the concept, they like what they're hearing, how can they get involved with Outernet?
So I'll tell you what, we're not here to hawk any of our wares. You know, maybe someday we will be, but right now it's a matter of, we want to be able to put together the best service that is possible. And it's not just a matter of the bits flying through the air, but I mean, it's an entire user experience. And so we want to make sure everything works and works all over the place. So if you, wherever you are in North America, that's the assumption is that you are, but wherever you are, that you can put together the requisite material to be able to download stuff, then please do let us know. A post on our forums, don't send us a direct email, because direct emails don't get shared, whereas if you're at discuss.outernet.is, then everyone else can be able to learn from what you've been able to come together and put together. So, I mean, like right now we have a gentleman in the UK, and he was saying, hey, you know what, I just bought all the kit. Now I'm going to go through the process and fully document whether or not your instructions work, and then I'll go ahead and let you know what signal quality is like and whether things are actually getting downloaded and how long it actually takes. So if people did that throughout North America, it would really be a benefit, because we're really kind of in the dark. Essentially, it's just a few of the core team who's in North America, and you know, but there's just so – G19, I mean, it goes from – what is it? From the southern borders of Canada all the way into the Caribbean. So
it goes all the way from Alaska – Northern Canada, all the way through Mexico and the Caribbean. So, yes, G19 coverage.
Yeah, and we would like to be able to see how coverage reacts. And also another thing is that if what's even better, this would be more powerful, is if any of your listeners knew of how to solve an information access problem. I know, you know, I have a skew of what life is and all over, you know, the U.S., but for example, in some disconnected communities, if they want something, you know, relay it to us. Like, we'll send books, we'll send Khan Academy videos. Basically, if it's in an internet packet, you know, we'll go ahead and send it off. So if there's demand for something, you know, we're not at the point where we're strictly following. I mean, there's limited users on the demand aggregation side, so we can go ahead and make and heed individual requests, as well as, you know, what books you want or whatever it is, and we can send them everywhere. And then you can also let us know that if they actually, you know, got delivered in there, it's entirely. So, you know, what's more important now than anything is just kind of some feedback as to whether what we're talking about is working.
All right. You know, something about was I knew that you're going to be on satellite, that you're going to be putting out this data. It sounded interesting what you were doing, but I didn't really see how it applied to me and my interests. But the more you talk about it, I see, you know, a lot of interest where I could, you know, tie in my my interest of the satellite along with, you know, some computer stuff and a card and that sort of thing. But it sounds like you're going way beyond, you know, just asking us to see if we can receive the signal.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are many puzzles to play with here. RF, there's when I say RF, it's a matter of, hey, we want to be able to make this as small and portable as possible, because that's, you know, that's really what a consumer product is about. So there's like, different dish designs, pedalization, things of that nature. There's software. Like almost most of what we're using right now is open source, but there's a little small. But we're working towards open sourcing that, and that's a puzzle in itself. And so we're going to ask for people's help and also just feedback on whether what we come up with actually works.
Right now, the way it is right now, could I use say any Linux computer or say BeagleBone? You know, it's like the Raspberry Pi.
To answer your question, a BeagleBone should work. You know, any flavor of an ARM development board will work. But getting down to unfortunately right now, a Linux laptop, that's not just yet. It's definitely high priority, but just not there just yet.
Okay, yeah, that answered my question on that.
And then, of course, what we have been talking about is our higher speed KU band service, but that's not the end all be all. We're really moving towards a mobile service as well, and it'll be a different service, but and we're hoping that will our first iteration of it will be available in the first quarter of the next year. And so what that will allow is a similar experience to now, but go directly to a device. Actually, it's not going straight to an iPhone or an Android, but with an RF front end, it will be able to use something like, let's say, a receiver that is equivalent to a square credit card reader, like a dongle that goes through the 3.5-millimeter audio jack. By using that, our target is to eventually be able to push between 50 and 100 megabytes a day to everyone in the world directly to a mobile device. Now, granted, that takes a little bit – that's a different kind of infrastructure that's involved, but, there's a need for – a lower speed mobile service that goes directly to the end user, and also a higher speed library service that creates this great archive. So we think the goal is to be able to create very realistically and very possibly a library in every home and a bookshelf in every pocket.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. You know, I'm just going to drive everybody to visit w.is, that's www.outernet.is. And there's a great forum on there. It looks like it's very active. I read through that some, and it looks like there's a lot of information being exchanged back and forth there. So, I'll just say, guys, if this is something that interests you, we have listeners in Europe. We have listeners all over the world. If this is something that interests you, check out their website. Get involved. Play with the technology. Give them feedback. And it will be really exciting to see where this project does go. As individuals, what can we do to help promote you, to promote the information about what you're trying to do? Are you to that point where you want people using social media to get behind and start talking about you?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think the most important thing that people could do in social media is we have it's called a thunderclap, and essentially what that means is at the same time, on the same date, everyone will go ahead and announce the same piece of content, and what that does is has like a viral and ripple effect across the entire internet. And so we're making a big announcement on September 4th, and the current thunderclap, so if you just Google thunderclap and OuterNet, and you make sure that it's thunderclap and information for the world from outer space, talking about it, describes the whole process, and what that'll happen, the impact of that will be, multiplicative. And what I mean by that is that the reason why the thunderclap is so important is that it gets Right now, we have a million people as being a part of the reaction of the thunderclap, and just adding your support, you know, through social media, whether it's Facebook or through Twitter, really, it multiplies your entire audience and that's being displayed at the same time. We're going to have this big announcement, and I have a really sharp video that I think is incredibly compelling on September 4th, which really hits back to the fact that, you know, we want to be humanity's public library. And, you know, going back to that earlier Frank discussion, was like, hey, we want to make sure that we're solving that issue when it comes to censorship and also information access, universal information access. And that I think hopefully that video goes a long way to be able to describe that. And if anyone wanted to participate in that.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, Syed Karim, founder and CEO of OuterNet. We want to thank you for being on the show this evening and letting our listeners know a little bit about OuterNet. So please visit www.outernet.is to learn more about OuterNet and get involved. Thank you so much for being on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it, Syed.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute with the call. So thanks, guys, for tuning in. We will be right back. Join us here live every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific for another exciting episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a live, one-hour weekly call-in radio show about the technology that we love. Every week, Satellite Nation features top industry news, interviews with the people and companies behind the products and services that change the world. Listen live to Satellite Nation for the inside scoop on the products and technology that we use every day. Meet and talk with the dreamers, innovators, developers of yesterday's, today's, and tomorrow's technologies. Satellite Nation airs here on Satellite Guys Radio and on work on Satellite Galaxy 19. Tune in every Wednesday night live at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Like us on Facebook. Let us know what you want to talk about, because it's your Satellite Nation.
It is now time for the Tech Corner. If you would like your question answered on the Tech Corner, please post your question on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio.
Michael, are we back?
We are back.
Oh, yeah, we are back. Hey, take it away, Michael.
All righty. This week on the Tech Corner, we have this question. Is it possible to hook up, say you've got a C-band dish motorized and you've got a KU-band dish motorized, and you want to hook them both up through the same G-box, B-box, ASC1, whatever, to your receiver? How would you do that properly?
How would you do that properly? Well, there's many ways, and it really depends on what equipment you have. So let's kind of approach it generically. You have a big C-band dish with a motor. You have a small KU-band dish with a motor. So that means on your big dish, you're going to have some controller like a G-box, V-box, or an ASC1. Well, the easiest way probably to connect a big satellite dish and a small satellite KU band motorized to a single receiver would be, take the output of the satellite receiver and loop through your GV box or ASC1, and then connect that loop out to the KU HH motor. Follow. Okay. So then, after it comes out of the KU motor, you'll then connect that loop out to your switch, your 22 kilohertz or your DISEC switch. Now, then you'll connect your C-band and your KU-band LMBS to your switch. Now, to operate this, you'll set your satellite receiver to select the correct LMB or the correct port on your switch to select the correct band. And the controls that I usually use on mine is that I'll send DISEC 1.2 commands for my C-band controller, and then I'll send either DISEC 1.2 or USALS commands to control my KU band. Now, I prefer to use USALS, so I devote my DISEC 1.2 commands over to C-band controller, and then I set up my USALS. Now, you probably know that there's some problems sometimes when you go through looping through things. Ever run into any problems with a little too much signal attenuation on your system?
Oh, yeah.
Well, when you hook it up looping through things, both your signal coming back from the LMB and the signal that goes out to control your 22 kilohertz switch and your DISEC switch, both can be attenuated by passing through this chain. So you might have trouble controlling your switch, or you might have trouble controlling the polarity, because the voltage gets attenuated slightly and the DISEC commands that control both DISEC 1.2 and USALS get attenuated as well. So then a second way that you could do your programming, go ahead. Oh, I thought you were going to ask something. Okay. So the second way that you would maybe hook this up is to connect your receiver to a high-quality splitter first, and then take one leg of the splitter over to your switch and then connect to your LMBFs. The other leg of your splitter would then go to the GV box or the ASC1 and then loop out to the KU-HH motor. The advantage to this way is that you're having a shorter path to your LMBs, and you'll get better signal returns. So the key to this is to have a good quality splitter and have good quality coax cable, and pick the method that's really best for your system. So what I've kind of presented here are two ways, very basic ways, but we could probably draw a diagram of ways to hook this up.
Oh, yeah. All kinds of different ways to do it. What I've run into before is I went in and forget to disconnect. I'm sitting up the C. I've got them all hooked up and forget to disconnect the C-band. Forget to disconnect the KU motor, and because I use USALS also with on one, and then the DISEC on the other one.
Yeah, when you use it that way, sometimes if you forget and you use DISEC 1.2 for both C band and KU band, you then program both motors to move at the same time. So you may be going to a KU, but the C-band dish moves. Why is this? Because you've programmed both the controller and the KU HH motor to respond to the same DISEC command. So that's one reason that I use DISEC 1.2 commands for the controller and USALS for the other. That way, when I'm programming the motors, I don't have to worry about disconnecting one or the other so it doesn't move when I issue that same command.
Yeah, same here. And yeah, sorry about that. I thought, I've done that, and you'll go to, and I've actually, especially when I first started setting it up like this, set it up and start punching in things, and the receiver's programming things. And I said, okay, it's doing good. And then I get to noticing, I'm looking out the window watching all this. Now, I'm excited about this. And I'll tell the C-band dish to go somewhere, and there goes the little dish. It's moving at the same time. I'm like, why are they both moving? And it hit me like, oh, I know why they're both moving. Yeah, I do something like I use the 1.2 for one and USALS for the other one. I love it the best. But sometimes, you know, as far as the arc, you may have to, you know, kind of mix and match a little bit on the...
Right, yeah. As you get to the ends of the arc with an HH motor, horizon-to-horizon KU motor, after a certain point, USAL sometimes doesn't calculate. You're right.
Yep, so I've had to do that. So I just unhook it, you know, and unhook one or the other to make it work and do whatever it's supposed to do, whatever I want to do, you know. So no biggie there. But that sure can happen.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it definitely when guys are hooking this up, you know, a lot of people want to go, hey, I just heard about FTA. I'm going to go out and I'm going to get this. I'm going to get that. I'm going to get all these motors. I'm going to do this and that. And I go, belly. Because as you and I know, figuring out these controls and kind of drawing a little piece of paper of, okay, if I put my equipment in this order, is the signal going to make it all the way through to that LNB? Or you know, what problems am I going to have? You know, if I put this command here, the dissect command, is it going to conflict with 22 kilohertz or a universal LNB and a standard LNB? So, yeah, definitely. You know, when you start considering putting multiple motors on the same system, check in with satellite guys. You know, come onto the forum. Ask some of the guys who have been doing this for years, have a ton of knowledge on the forums, and definitely would guide anybody out there if you're considering, you know, installing a motorized system. The forums are the place to go. These guys have a ton of experience.
Yeah, and don't run through your switch first to put your switches after your motor, because you can burn them up. And I know there's a couple switches out there that can't handle
it.
It sounded
like you were in the dungeon of doom there. Thank you, Skype. Thank you, IP. Come on back. What was that again? What did you say there, Michael?
Yeah, I forgot what the punchline was, but it's starting to storm here, so it's not. He just was to the end. But.
It sounds like maybe you just direct hit.
I don't think it's that close yet, but it might be something down the road.
Well, we don't want to lose you and have to take a memorial fundraising at the end of the show. So be safe. Let me know if lightning's coming your way. Take it from me. Watch out for it.
Oh, yeah. We learned that last week, didn't we?
Well,
what I was saying was just don't go through the switch. Make sure you go to the motor first and then to your switches. And I know there's some switches out there that can handle the current, but most of them can't. And if you're not sure, you know, it's just better just to go, you know, after you come out of your V-Box or your ASC1, go to that USALS motor first, your HH motor, and then come out to your switches, and, you know, like you said.
Definitely. Now, another thing to think about is some switches are different than other switches in their sensitivity. This morning I was talking on the phone to Deanne, and she was just talking about different ways that she's hooked up her system, you know, where she's put switches, et cetera. And it made me remember that not everybody out there knows that some switches don't need as much signal to reliably switch between inputs, where other switches need more signal. Another thing to consider is some receivers output less, both 22 kilohertz and dissect, because dissect really is 22 kilohertz. It's just a modulated. Well, I see we're getting really close to the end of our show here. Let's talk about... what's going on next? You know, I think we definitely want people to check out Facebook and to interact with us on Facebook. Give us some ideas for future tech talks or future guests that you would like featured on Satellite Nation.
For sure. Get on it. Facebook at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. Like our page and get in there and let us know, like I said before, let us know what you'd like to hear on the show, plus give us some questions and give us some ideas for the Tech Corner. We're very interactive over there.
Now, I want to put out a special thanks to Saeed Farim, founder, CEO of OuterNet, for being our special guest. A special shout-out thanks to Scott over at Satellite Guys Radio for carrying Satellite Nation, Dave over at Got C-Band Satellite, and Ralph over at Access America for putting us on streaming and up on the Galaxy 19 satellite. This week we're hosted by Dave's IceCast server over at his PC farm there. So we really want to thank him for helping us get up and sounding good. So let's see. Just want to invite everybody to join in next week at this same time, this same station. We're going to be on Galaxy 19 next week. We're going to be on Satellite Guys Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific.
Yep, for sure. We'll look forward to seeing everybody next week.
Well, very good. So until next week, we just want to take care of you guys. Have a great one. Operate your satellites in a safe and sane manner, and check out OuterNet, and that is www.outernet.is. So thank you very much. We'll catch you next week.
Good night, everyone.